The Amazon rainforest is the richest ecosystem on Earth and the largest unexplored habitat that's still home to native peoples. The Lost Tribes of the Amazon, Joshua Hammer's cover story in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine, takes a look at conservation efforts to protect the plants, animals, and the people who live there. And joining us now to discuss the importance of these efforts is Mark Plotkin, an ethnobotanist, the founder of the Amazon Conservation Team, and author of several books, including the critically acclaimed Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Plotkin to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, great to be back on the show.
The article explains some of the history of isolated tribes in the Amazon rainforest, focusing mainly on the ways that they have purposely avoided contact with the rest of the world. How have these tribes been so much more successful at avoiding assimilation than people in other parts of the world?
Well, you know, Leonard, a lot of people don't understand that the Colombian Amazon is a pretty big place. The Colombian Amazon that most people think is a little suburb of Brazil is bigger than New England. So that's a lot of rainforest, it's a lot of land, and it's pretty easy to get lost there.
And these are mostly in the Colombian Amazon?
The focus of the article on the cover of Smithsonian Magazine is all in the Colombian Amazon. There are some uncontacted tribes across the border in Brazil. There may be some uncontacted groups across the border in Ecuador, but it's our belief that the major stronghold in terms of the most tribes is in the Colombian Amazon, and that's the focus of the piece.
And in his piece, Jonathan Hammer describes a recent expedition by small plane to find uncontacted Amazonian tribes in order to prove their existence and pinpoint their location so that they can be protected. Well, how much can you learn peering through the thick jungle canopy?
Well, you know, really, the more you know about something, the more you know about something. I can look at a longhouse, what they call a maloca, from the air, and tell if it's from one tribe or another. And when you see these longhouses, these malocas being very different, you know it's not all the same tribe. So this is what ethnobotanists would describe as just a trick of the trade.
And how can these groups continue to avoid outside influence when they can now so easily be found with technology? Are you respecting their desire not to be contacted? Is that why they can continue to avoid outside influence?
Exactly. I mean, my organization, the Amazon Conservation Team, is launched what we're calling the Leave Them Alone Initiative, which is to find out where they are, have them declared protected areas, work with Colombian government to enact legislation, which in fact we've already done, to keep people out, and then essentially to put that legislation in place and work with the neighboring tribes to keep outsiders out. That's loggers, that's diamond miners, maybe guerrilla, whatever. We want to leave these people alone, and if they want contact with the outside world, they know where to find us.
But then you have to go up against the political realities of countries like Colombia. Has it been better about these things than Brazil?
They really have. As I said, we've helped them enact legislation to protect these people. It has not set off a gold rush of pouring people into these areas. In Peru, you have what they call human safaris, where you can pay people to take you into uncontacted or recently contacted peoples. So the Colombians have really been very progressive on this. We all like to think of Colombia as a terrible country riven by problems. Well, that's true everywhere. And I would say that the situation in Colombia has markedly improved. In fact, there are peace talks underway as we speak. And I'm not Pollyanna. It's not a cakewalk. But I will say that the Colombians have been very forward-thinking, and a special tip of the hat to President Santos, who has helped this legislation go through. So we're feeling pretty good about it.
Although there are pressures, I'm sure, to do other things with the land. And then aren't there various groups, paramilitary groups that also move around in these areas?
Well, the guerrilla threat has diminished greatly in the last couple of years. It's not done, but it's really restricted to more highland areas outside of the lowlands where these people occur. So, you know, if you're a conservationist, you never run out of problems and challenges. And the great mistake of the environmental movement, whether it's here at home in the U.S. or in the Amazon, is to do something good like create a park, create a protected area, and think you've won the war. You haven't won the war. You've won the battle. A perfect example of that was there was some gold mining recently near, I think it was Yellowstone, and the fumes were going to be flowing into the park. And so we had to go back and refight that battle. So the short answer to your question is environmentalism needs to be a war in a positive way, which you don't walk away from a victory or a defeat and give up, because there's always further challenges you're going to have to meet.
Now, when you say Yellowstone, you're talking about Yellowstone in the United States?
Yes, I am.
So the same sorts of issues apply here as they do in the Amazon or in Indonesia or any number of other areas where there environments that we want to see protected.
The bottom line is we live in a world where everybody's gone crazy for resources. In the old days, in the Cold War, where you had the world divided into two armed camps, a lot of little places like Guyana in South America, Suriname, Nicaragua, were really just not on the chopping block for resource exploitation, and now they are. So what we need to do is have increased diligence across the board to realize that in the age of the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, in the age where Canadian mining companies are creating real problems in the Amazon, all resources everywhere are coveted. And we need to protect those resources, manage them well, and work with the people who live there so that everybody benefits.
It was surprising, I learned from the article, that many of the current Amazonian tribes are not uncontacted tribes who have never seen outsiders, but groups that have chosen to retreat a century or more ago. Can you tell us about those tribes?
Well, it's a good point, and one that I don't entirely agree with. The lead anthropologist in Colombia on this issue, a fellow named Roberto Franco, suggested virtually all of these 14 tribes took refuge during the rubber boom when the world went crazy for rubber and started enslaving Indians, killing Indians who didn't meet the rubber quotas. And these are tribes that had contact 100 years ago and ran off in the jungle. I think that's probably true for a number of these, maybe half of these. But I do think that some of these groups have never been in contact with the outside world and have chosen not to be. One of my best friends was an uncontacted Indian. He's an Acorio from the northeast Amazon. These were hunter-gatherers. They did not know agriculture. They did not know how to make fire. If you want to say an Acorio, he has died, you say, Mato Nenge. His fire has gone out. That's how important fire was to them. But they saw planes overhead, and they didn't know what they were. It never occurred to them there were people inside. So they knew there was something going on they couldn't explain, but they just didn't have contact with the outside world until a couple of decades ago.
Although I've heard that in some cases, if steel axes and metal cooking utensils are left, they will take them even if they don't want to come in contact with the people who leave them.
Well, if you've ever tried to chop down a tree with a stone axe, which I did as an experiment, you see the advantage of trying to do it with metal. So it's hardly surprising these people want cool tools. I mean, who doesn't? But it is amazing to me, and probably to a lot of people out there, that there are still people roaming the world that don't have iPads and don't have iPods, and are content to pretty much live the way they always have.
One reason that some people have suggested these tribes have retreated into the rainforest is their lack of immunity to foreign diseases. So how do you address that kind of problem when you're interacting with isolated native groups?
That's a key issue. And to go back to the example of the Acorios from the northeast Amazon, when they came into contact with the outside world and they were contacted by the missionaries and brought into Indian settlements, basically all adults were dead within 2 years from introduced diseases. They had no immunity, and Western medicine couldn't save them. So anytime you're dealing with uncontacted groups, this has to be first and foremost in your mind. And I want to make real clear that my group, the Amazon Conservation Team, is not making contact. We're working with the local government to keep people out. Now, we are preparing that if contact is made, which some point it will be, that we have the medical infrastructure there to go in and vaccinate people to deal with the diseases which are a real threat. Have always been a real threat and will always be. But we want to do this with our eyes open, and we want to do it in a smart way, and we want to learn from the mistakes of the past.
And what are the most dangerous diseases? Diseases that we would think we're immune to, but they are not?
In going back and reading these accounts as we're doing this work, there are accounts of people dying of measles, mumps, chicken pox, malaria, dysentery. So, I'm not a physician, But what is clear is not having developed immunity to things that we either know how to deal with, at least our immune system does, or we're vaccinated against, these people are defenseless. That's why it's important for us to raise the money, which we're trying to do, to have this type of infrastructure in place. So again, we're not being Pollyannish and think if we keep the outside world at bay, these people will live happily ever after. There's a real threat. There's a real threat from contact. There's indeed a threat by trying to avoid contact. But you know that great old saying of Louis Pasteur's that chance favors the prepared mind.
Many of these tribes were treated so successfully that they were thought to be extinct. Do we are we sure that we know about all of them? Might there be other tribes that are hidden that we still haven't seen?
I suspect that we'll find a couple of other tribes in the course of further research. But for example, one of the tribes we found most recently is in an area that used to be inhabited by a group known as the Carijones. Now, the Carijones were the last cannibal tribe of the Northwest Amazon, and there are 7 Carijones left living in contact with civilization. And they assured me personally that in the old days they were cannibals, or their ancestors were. But because this is in the traditional area of the Carijones, we think they are Carijones. Now, it might be that they're an entirely new tribe that nobody's ever heard of, but the important thing, the urgent thing, is to protect these people, protect these forests, and do things in the right way.
Do they all speak in similar languages?
There are 4 major language groups in the Amazon, 4 or 5, and the Carijones, for example, are members of the Carib language group. Some of the others that are in the area are members or believed to be members of the Tupi language group. But there's a wonderful new book out by Napoleon Chagnon, who is an anthropologist who worked with the Yanomami, and their language is not related to anybody or anything anywhere, and they seem to have some genetic anomalies as well. So it's not impossible. These people are what we call isolates. And, you know, nobody can explain that.
I'm talking with Mark Plotkin, who is an ethnobotanist, the founder of the Amazon Conservation Team. The last time we spoke, it was mostly about your work as an ethnobotanist, and we'll address some of those things again in our second part of this conversation. Among his books is the critically acclaimed Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Mark Plotkin, who is the founder of the Amazon Conservation Team, author of several books, including Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice. We're talking about the Lost Tribes of the Amazon, which is the subject of an article in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine, written by Joshua Hammer. Can we talk a bit about your organization, Amazon Conservation Team? How is it different from other conservation groups?
Well, we work at the grassroots in partnership with indigenous peoples. We define the Amazon Conservation Team as a group that protects the rainforest by working in close partnership with the indigenous peoples that live there. And we have done this now with 32 tribes to better protect 70 million acres of rainforest by teaching Indians how to map, manage, and protect their lands. We're the group that has guys in breechcloths walking around with GPSs, which is the perfect marriage of ancient shamanic wisdom and 21st century U.S. know-how.
And when you started the team in 1996 with conservationist Liliana Madrigal, were there similar organizations working at that time?
You know, there were organizations where I used to work, like World Wildlife Fund, that focused on protecting the rainforest, and there were organizations like Cultural Survival that focused on protecting indigenous culture. But my feeling as an ethnobotanist, if there's no rainforest, there's no Indians, and if there's no Indians, there's no rainforest. So we decided to work with forests to protect Indians and work with Indians to protect forests.
And then there are people who also are concerned that if we don't have rainforest, we're going to have more serious problems with climate change. Is that something you had in mind when you got involved in your preservation work in the Amazon?
Nobody was talking about this 30 years ago, but people were talking about zero population growth. And when we tried to talk about rainforest, people would say, we can't worry about that now. We have to worry about population growth. Now they say we can't worry about rainforest because we have to worry about climate change. Well, one thing you learn in working with shamans, medicine men in the Amazon, medicine men and women, is the interconnectedness of all things. So, of course, what was destroying the rainforest was overpopulation, and what's changing the climate is the carbon put in the air, much of it by destroying the rainforest. So it all connects.
And the rainforest in Brazil especially has been endangered through logging and mining and cattle ranching. And the Brazilian government, at least, has been ambivalent about it, hasn't it? Because it also sees these things as necessary for the Brazilian economy.
Well, look, we all need development, and I'm not advocating that everybody move into grass houses and go to the bathroom in the jungle, although I do plenty of both. The bottom line is that there's development and there's smart development. And when you see the drought that's caused by cutting down forests, and when you see that rivers are silted up by cutting down forests, you realize there's a price to pay. And I've actually had Brazilians, educated people, say to my face, well, you cut down your forest and you killed indigenous peoples and you're a great country. So who are you to tell us what to do? And my response is, I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm just saying we should all learn from mistakes that have been made before us. And so I think there's lessons to be learned by all people everywhere in the types of environmental mistakes that have been made. And the Brazilians have a lot of great organizations, and there's a lot of great conservationists. But I will say that we do not find the government as devoted to conservation as the government of Colombia, for example. But like I said, there's good and not so good people everywhere.
Well, you also can enact laws, but then you have to actually carry out. You have to make sure that the laws are obeyed. So there are laws, aren't there, in all of these countries? But then the government sometimes looks the other way.
Well, that's a key point, because there are laws, but there also has to be enforcement. And one of the things I'm most proud of here at the Amazon Conservation Team, which people can find on the web at amazonteam.org, is that we are the ones who created indigenous park guard forces. So we have trained the Indians how to patrol their lands, how to work with the government. We've given them walkie-talkies, and we've created, empowered them, really, to take charge of their own cultural and environmental destiny. That is true grassroots conservation, and it's been marvelously effective.
And you've also included maps. Is integral to your mission. How do they
maps
work?
Maps are key. You know, more land has been controlled, managed, protected, claimed with maps and with bullets and swords combined.
The Amazon Conservation Team runs an ethno-education program for Native children. What's ethno-education?
Well, there's very little educational opportunity in many of these remote villages, and the ones that are there are typically run by missionaries, and the focus is on Western religion and on Western wildlife and agriculture, cows and pigs and chickens. What we've done is develop materials so that the kids are learning from the grandmas and the grandpas, from the elders of their tribe, and they're learning traditional medicinal plant use, they're learning traditional agriculture, traditional songs and handicrafts. And it's not saying you shouldn't learn about the outside world, but we think if you're just teaching kids about foreign cultures, they will not value their own.
Do some people wander out of these isolated tribes, interested in what's going on in the outside world?
Of course, and that's their right to do so. We have no business telling people what they should or shouldn't do. What we're trying to do is create opportunities and to say that, look, you may go to the capital city, but job opportunities there you may find as surprisingly limited, so that don't buy this idea that by moving to the city you're going to get two cars and air conditioning. That's seldom open to tribal peoples. Anybody who's been to Mexico City or Rio de Janeiro sees the slums that surround the capital city, and these are people, Indians and peasants, who moved to the capital city in search of a better life. And I would say in most instances, they don't find it.
The last time you were on the show, we talked about how you study the way Amazonian shamans use plants for medicine. What's the difference between an ethnobotanist and an anthropologist who focuses on plant use?
We are trained to study the plants and the people and are equally interested in both, where I'd say most anthropologists are primarily interested in the people and the culture. So I like to think because we can talk plants with the best of the shamans, that gives us an ability to understand and relate with these people in a way that you can't if you're just talking about cultural aspects.
And some of these plants turn out to have real possibilities for treating illnesses that we haven't been able to invent medicines for?
Well, that's why I think it's important that we respect these cultures and these forests. Our system of medicine is the most sophisticated ever devised, but we don't have the cure for pancreatic cancer. We don't have the cure for breast cancer. We don't have the cure for acid reflux. We don't have the cure for insomnia. And I think some of these people and some of these plants hold answers to some of these questions that we don't have answers to. In fact, I know they do.
And do the shamans actually cure people of illnesses that Western doctors can't cure them of?
I have seen stuff that boggles my mind as a Western scientist. So I would say absolutely they can cure some things we can't, but they don't have all the answers. If you have appendicitis, you don't want to go to a shaman or a nutritionist or a music therapist. But if you have an illness which has a strong emotional component, like insomnia, for example, you may be better off with a shaman than you are with your family doctor.
The shamans also make use of the psychedelic plants in the rainforest. Do they have uses beyond tribal ceremonies?
Absolutely. My mentor, Richard Schultes at Harvard, and I wrote about him in the new issue of Harvard Magazine, which is on the web. You don't need a password to get in. About Schultes and Hamilton Rice went into the northwest Amazon, where they found Indians using the sacred hallucinogen ayahuasca, the vine of the soul, which seems to offer great potential for treating certain emotional illnesses. There's a lot of experimentation going on, some of it not scientific, but this is learned of from these Indians and is extracted from these forests, absolutely.
On the other hand, are you concerned that some Western scientists and pharmaceutical companies will take advantage of these shamans and their medicinal practices?
Well, that's definitely been a worry, that the history of using indigenous wisdom and local plants has not been a happy one for indigenous peoples. I mean, if you look at an American breakfast of cornflakes and Rice Krispies and hot chocolate and coffee and tea and bananas and pineapple, that's all indigenous, essentially tropical plants, and the people never got anything for it. Same thing with the medicines we use that come from indigenous peoples. They never got anything for it. So I hope if this type of exploration goes forward, it goes forward in a way which benefits these people, benefits the government of the countries they live in, and then benefits us as well.
But then you'd also have to find a way to grow these plants in large quantities if they are effective, or you just simply mine the Amazon.
Well, I wrote a book a couple of years back called Medicine Quest, and I talked about cone snails, which are these poisonous snails that live on coral reefs that offer these peptides, these proteinaceous compounds, which are useful as a painkiller. And there aren't enough cone snails in the world to supply the world with all the painkillers it needs. So on day two of finding this, we're able to synthesize it in the lab. So it's not all based on, you know, what can we extract from the forest or the coral reef. Some of this stuff can be synthesized in the lab or made more effective or made less toxic. So it's not the microchip or the medicine man. It's some combination of both.
And when you say a painkiller, are we talking about something that would substitute for opiates or something that would substitute for aspirin?
The idea is that it would substitute for opiates, and it's non-addictive. It operates in a different way in the human body.
So
it could be a billion-dollar drug.
Wow, that would be incredibly promising. In some cases, things that look like they could be promising, something in Asia that seemed to keep people, or is it in Africa, keep people thin, they've not been able to market it.
You know, I'm just a biologist. I can't speak to the marketing and the business aspects. I know there's great stuff out there, whether it's losing weight, whether it's treating so-called incurable diseases, and I want to protect all of it to benefit everybody.
And do you have hope for these tribes that desire not to have contact with the outside world being able to maintain their lifestyle?
In the short term, I'm very hopeful, especially with this legislation, especially with this Leave Them Alone initiative to try and raise the money to protect them and their forests and let them emerge at their own way, at their own rate, and do it in the right way and not repeat the mistakes of the past.
I've been talking with Mark Plotkin, an ethnobotanist, the founder of the Amazon Conservation Team. We've been talking about the lost tribes of the Amazon, which are the subject of an article by Joshua Hammer in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us again.
A pleasure, and I look forward to next time.